dukkha around talks. I think I'm quite fortunate in that sense. And it really started because when my parents were going through a lot of their fighting, it was one of the iterations of the separation, but not the final one. I think a teacher, when I was like 10 years old in grade 5, had picked up on something was up at home and then signed me up for public speaking contests. So I was like this 10-year-old speaking in front of a couple hundred people. And because I'm in Montreal, a lot of the contests were in French, but I was talking about rainforests in English. And that really, I didn't realize that, decades later, that would really help me. And yet, I'm watching the time, and as it would get closer to 7:40 and less people trickle in, just noticing the shortening of the breath and the increase of the heart beating, the clamminess of the hands all of a sudden. And then I remember I have a body, and it suddenly kind of goes away or makes it bearable or okay again. So I'm just so thankful always for this practice. So perhaps you've heard over the week that this is a path of purification. That's one way that it can be described. And I've certainly said that more than once in some of the groups that I've had. And I've even used this image because it very much resonates for me, or it's reflective of my own practice. When I think of purification, I, for some reason, thought of laundry. And then I thought how, then I thought how, oh yeah, well, there's all sorts of ways that we could launder our clothes. And then when I look around the hall sometimes and I see people seemingly so peaceful, I'm like, oh, their purification is like on the delicate cycle. Or like warm water with that special soap and it's hand washed or something. When a lot of my retreat practice, despite me looking happy, it feels like a lot of my practice is, or it feels as if it's stuck on the spin cycle. And it's not very pleasant, to say the least. And I had such a hard time on a few retreats, some of my longer retreats, that I suspected that the teachers were on the brink of telling me to do something else. And I'm pretty convinced. I've never asked them, but I'm pretty convinced. And yet I was relentless. I continued to practice. And I remember one teacher said, "You didn't leave the retreat after all that," or something like that. And I was like, and then suddenly I was like, I could have left. But anyways, I was still there. And so I think it's because a part of me just really felt that despite the spin cycleness of the felt sense of how my practice had unfolded and often unfolded, that it was my birthright, that I belonged, even though in a lot of ways the reflections I would get back were messages that I didn't belong in some ways, because, say, the food was never food that I was quite familiar with at lunch or in the dining hall, or the teacher body or much of the student body didn't reflect me, or I would not always hear my own experiences. And so even though there was a lot of messages that told me in some ways that I didn't belong, there's a part of me that knew that these practices, regardless, were ones that I could belong to. And so that's what I love about this practice, that regardless of what we're coming with or how we are or how we show up, that this is our birthright, that freeing the heart and mind belongs to all of us. And I'm not sure if some of you have decided this would be your last retreat. I know it's your first retreat for some of you, but I hope it's not going to be your last. But all this to say is that in this evening's talk, I just want to share with you a little bit of my journey and give you even more of a glimpse into my heart and mind. And the stops we'll make along the way will be metta and compassion and pit stop by Kuan Yin and then Sangha and end up somewhere together. I hope we'll end up on the same page. Are you ready? Buckle up. No. And so I'm a second generation Filipina Canadian, and I'm the daughter of immigrants. And part of my upbringing was one of assimilation, but it also included being around my parents who were often in survival mode, where at the end of the day, it wasn't like, how are you? How do you feel? It was more like, eat this and don't do that, and other messages like, don't cause trouble or we'll, and I interpreted it as, or we'll get sent back home. Even though I was born in Canada, that was just kind of like the underlying current. I also internalized the message that I needed to earn love. And it's not because I was lacking for anything, but it was more like because my parents were so in that survival mode. And for those of you who know love languages, maybe their love language was acts of service. When mine is affection and or touch and words of affirmation. And so because our love languages based on our upbringings, you know, I didn't have to move across the world into a country that I need to learn all these new things and the language and whatnot. So because of that disconnect, I felt like I needed to earn love. And so my lifelong battle with perfectionism began. And that's my personal arriving at perfectionism. And I know there's a lot of perfectionists in the room. And so we all have our own backdrop or story to it. But my quest for perfectionism led me to practice. Not because I was like, oh, let me be free from this perfectionism. It was more because, and I didn't tell anybody until like a few years after I started practicing, maybe like 5 years, I finally admitted, it's because I want to fix parts of myself. And then I kind of laugh at this now, but one of the things I wanted was to use mindfulness to become an introvert. I don't know why, but I don't know. I just thought, wow, introverts, like, they just have such a peaceful life or some. I don't know. I don't know why. But anyways, it didn't work, as you can see. And there's many other things that I had come to practice wanting to fix. And thanks to a lot of the teachers, they picked up on it. And over the years, teacher after teacher would prescribe me metta, loving kindness practice. And like any good student, I approached my metta practice like a perfectionist. And so I was like, yes, I got the phrases down all the time. And I was like, may I be happy? Not happy yet. May I be free? And I was pretty intense about it, to say the least. And what I realized now, but it took me a couple years of practicing metta in that super intense way, to notice that I was holding myself to a really high standard using the practice. So I, in other words, I was misusing the practice. So I hear there's this beautiful quality, this divine abode that's limitless and boundless, loving kindness, metta. And at the end of the day, I would be like, well, was I loving and kind today? Nope, not then. No, not really. Oh, yeah, no, because I was thinking different things when I sent that email. You know, and so I would just basically use the practice as another tool for self-judgment and self-hatred, mostly because that's what I had been doing for decades. And yet, I trusted my teachers enough, especially because they were still always telling me to practice metta. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's been years. But then I started tuning into that there had to be more than just that ideal, that it couldn't just be so binary, so cut and dry, like you were either loving and kind or not. And so what I learned was how I practice was the key, not whether I managed to open my heart and jam it or keep it open. The Buddha in the Anguttara Nikaya has said, when the mind is scattered, know that the mind is scattered. When the mind is gathered, know that the mind is gathered. He didn't say, when the mind is scattered, geez, that's not a good thing. You're doing something wrong. You don't belong here. Don't sign up for another retreat. Don't tell anyone. There's none of that. Instead, he's saying, can you be fully and non-judgmentally aware that it's just like this right now? I've heard Jack Kornfield paraphrase that quote from the Buddha in the following way, and I'm going to use my hand as a demonstration, so in case your eyes are closed. And so I've seen Jack once hold his hand up and he'll say, is this a heart? So my hand is wide open. Is this a heart? And then some people would say, no. You know, meaning, is the heart only open? It's like, no. And then he'd say, is this a heart? The hand is closed now. Or is the heart only closed? And it's like, no. And then this is a heart, one that opens and one that closes. And then I like to add, and our task as practitioners is to simply know when the heart is open and when the heart is closed. Not to jam it open and not to use when it's closed as a tool for self-hate or self-judgment. And because of that, and partly also from the Sri Nisargadatta quote of wisdom tells me I am nothing and love tells me I am everything, and between the two, my life flows. I think Kittisaro shared that this week. And also from the teachings of Larry Yang, so he's now retired but has taught here at Spirit Rock for many decades and was a mover and shaker and trailblazer in so many ways and mindfulness and Dharma communities around diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. And so some of his teachings have also opened me up to thinking of things on spectrums. And so I've shared that already this week in the Q&A when there was a question on non-harming or non-violence. And so now I tend to try and think of this practice in a much more lively and organic way, where a lot of these qualities that we hear of or that you've heard of this week during the retreat, to place it on a spectrum. And so, for example, with loving kindness, if it's on one end of the spectrum, and according to the teachings, the far enemy is hate, well, then in between, and then again, I think of Nisargadatta, well, in between, my life flows. And so some days, all I can do is get to non-hate. Other days, I might get to tolerance or acceptance, maybe friendliness. Usually the days I sleep and eat well, basically. And then when I'm really friendly or when I have that inclination towards friendliness, then sometimes there's this intimacy where I want to continue moving toward. And then sometimes I get to loving kindness, metta. But then to the perfectionists and box checkers out there, watch out. Just because we get to metta one day or many days in a row even, doesn't mean that our work is done. Because we can slide up and down at any point. Things can change. It can get cloudy or something. And then for whatever reason, we're somewhere else on the spectrum. But just to recognize that it's this living, breathing thing and there's no one place to arrive to. With so many parts of this practice, but in particular with loving kindness, I believe, or the heart qualities. And then Tanisra talked this morning so beautifully about compassion, karuna. And so compassion is the natural response of the heart when the heart has touched into this quality of loving kindness. So it's a natural response. But perfectionists, I see you. And so I was contemplating, well, what could be a spectrum for compassion in case some of you are like, oh, this world needs compassion. How do I get it? Or something like that. And then if you're like me, you're a little intense and graspy about it. And I invite you to consider what is your spectrum. And so I'm just exploring or sharing what it has or how it has arisen for me. But it's not like the way. It's just Dawn's way right now. It may change in a few months or in a few years. The next time we talk, you might be like, that's not what you said in 2021 or something like that. And it changes. And explore for yourself, ehipasiko. And so a possible spectrum for compassion could be from going from cruelty, so that's the far enemy, to non-cruelty or non-harm. And then allowing, making space for. And then that friendliness, this care about suffering, and then compassion. And yet, the state of the world is getting more intense, more extreme, more divided. We know that. Doesn't take much to remind us. There's loss and trauma, estrangement, racial, systemic, political, and environmental suffering. And as Tanisra was reminding us last night and this morning, it's undeniable that we need to do things differently. And one of the ways that I can think of that we can do things differently, there's many, many ways, but one way is or includes thinking that we can do it on our own, that we can hold all of this on our own. I think in a lot of ways, it's that thinking that has gotten us in this predicament, this individualism. And so I just want to share a couple ways that help me hold it all. Because one way that, I mean, I could hold it is by turning away from it completely. Never reading the news, going off social media, and pretending that it's all blissful. Ignorance is bliss. But I don't think that that would be a service, actually, to anybody, to any of you and to future generations. And so I choose to turn toward it, and it's not easy, as you know, and as we've been pointing to. And so one of the ways that really helps me is turning to the sacred. So we've been talking about that in many different ways all week. Of course, there's the chanting and the bowing. Those are physical manifestations as well that we can turn toward the sacred. And then we've been talking about listening. And so I try to listen for messages of the sacred. And just like Gulu had shared in his talk, he said something like, when talking about practicing at Dharmagiri, something like, and the gods of the mountains were angry. I never thought I would say that sentence or something like that. And I never thought I would be sharing this, actually, what I want to share with you, let alone on a recorded talk at Spirit Rock. Because this is one of the parts that I thought didn't belong, actually. And then it's thanks to the field of love and acceptance that both Tanisra and Kittisaro create that Kittisaro actually was the first teacher I told this to, and it was at Dharmagiri on that retreat where the gods were mad at Gulu. But basically, a few years ago when I was on a long retreat, I was just practicing in an unwise way. I was like over-efforting and to the point where I was like I was manic. I was on the brink of a panic attack, and I knew it, and I was like already crying uncontrollably. So this is the spin cycle mode. I was crying uncontrollably for, I felt like weeks, and I would like wail in my room and then wipe my face and come out thinking that the walls were and the halls weren't like were soundproof, but people would look at me concerned anyways. And so there was one day that I was totally manic. I had my yogi job in the morning, but I was like losing it, and I was crying, and I was like pacing on the front lawn at IMS. Those of you know, I was pacing back and forth, and then I was like, gotta get it together, because the perfectionist in me was like, you still gotta show up to your job. And I was like, get it together. And so then I went out for a walk in the woods. And those of you who know the area, there's this beautiful pond, Gaston Pond, and a big rock there. And I remember just crying and just thinking of it now, just there's so much suffering. And I remember laying on that rock and I was just like, I can't do this. I can't do this. And I was saying it out loud. And I thought I was like far enough in the woods that no one could hear. And I was like, I can't do this. I can't do this. I feel like I'm breaking. And I was just crying and crying. And then all of a sudden I heard, oh, my child, but you are. You're breaking free. That wiped up the tears real quick, because I was like, who said that? I was just like kind of freaked out, but also it just came from this deep place, this intuitive knowing that was referred to this week. And I was like, ah, I'm breaking free. Yes, that's what I'm doing. And then I stayed on the retreat, and that's why the teacher was like, you're still here. You didn't leave. I didn't know who or what that was then, at least, but it felt wise and deep and safe and trustworthy. And from there, I didn't give her the name Kuan Yin. Actually, she told me her name was the Great Mother. And I didn't want to be this fair weather friend to the Great Mother where I was like, hey, bail me out whenever I'm really manic or something like that. And so that retreat, I really tried to cultivate a relationship with her. I would walk around the loop and just kind of like tune into her and say, hey girl, how you doing? And then she was funny. Like at one point I was like trying to trick her. I said, can you tell me what you look like so that I could like properly visualize you? And then her reply was, don't get attached to form. And I was like, oh, you too, kind of thing. And then at some point on that retreat, when I was walking around the loop, there just felt like this merging all of a sudden. That yes, Kuan Yin was coming and helping me hold my suffering, helping me break free. And yet she wasn't outside of me. She was part of me. And then that really affirmed to me that I could call on her at any time, not just given those conditions of being on retreat and being quiet, etc. And so I try to talk to her often, actually, not just when I want things. And again, I still don't really understand, like I can't explain it, like, oh, it's because of X, Y, Z. No, there's no logical explanation. And I actually think that that's quite beautiful, because I was thinking this afternoon, if I could explain everything in my life, it would be a pretty boring or isolated life. And so I'm happy that there's mystery and divine. We talked about that in one of my groups as well, that there's this divine presence, this divine holding. There was another time, this is coming up just spontaneously, but I was again walking around that loop at IMS, and then I had said something like, whoa, you're way more green today than yesterday. And I was talking to, in my mind, to Moss. And so Kuan Yin was manifesting as this moss, and then the moss replied, I'm using air quotes, replied to me saying, am I? And I said, I don't know. And then the moss said, well, you're the one talking to moss, or something like that. And so it was just, it's like such a beautiful relationship, basically. So even though I'm saying this in the context of suffering, there could be joy too. And Kuan Yin listens to the cries of the world and holds joys and sorrows, not just sorrows. Another thing that helps me, in addition to turning toward the sacred, is turning toward the collective. And so that's us. Tanisara shared in her first talk, when we turn inward and we get to really know our suffering, so we see the first noble truth, and then the vow or the invitation with that truth is to really know it. And in my experience, when I get really, really intimate with my suffering, when I really know it, the personal characteristics of my suffering tends to fall away. And then unexpectedly, what I feel happens is like I go through this doorway or threshold where then suddenly the collective qualities of my suffering start to reveal itself. Like, it doesn't matter what my story is or what your story is. It's my suffering is yours and yours is mine, because there's some shared understanding in it. When I can deeply know suffering, I don't need to know the details of yours. I just know that it hurts, that it can feel unbearable, that you don't want to be in it. And perhaps you can borrow the strength that I carved out from when I knew deeply my own suffering. And then I consider it kind of like a paying it forward, so that when you come through that suffering, then maybe the next time when you meet somebody else, from that carving out, that emptiness that Kittisaro referred to, that responds, you can be that for somebody else, and on and on. There was a poem I shared with another one of my groups by Danielle Laporte. I think it's quite beautiful. Perhaps you'll like it too. And the title is, May My Suffering Be of Service. When the suffering is almost intolerable, when you've had all you think you can take, when you can't comprehend what the gift in the pain might be, when it's not making any sense, when you're asking God, life, why? There's this. May my suffering be of service, at the very least. May some good come out of this. If not for me, for someone else. Some good, at the very least. May my suffering be of service. And this sort of thing gets clarified through practice, not through thought, so that intuitive knowing again. Because when we think we can go it alone, when we can hold all that's happening alone, we risk being overwhelmed, frozen in inaction. And as we've been alluding to all week, there's no more time for this inaction. It's quite urgent. An Huang Nguyen, a nun from the Thich Nhat Hanh lineage, has said, place your suffering in the cradle of the Sangha. Place your suffering in the cradle of the Sangha. Some of you might know this teaching of Sangha, community of practitioners, enlightened ones. It's the third jewel that we chant to quite often, every day, a few times even. But it's the jewel that kind of gets left out on retreat a lot of times. It's considered also the imperfect jewel because it's the jewel that kind of rubs you the wrong way sometimes, but in a liberating way. Kittisaro talked about how we can wake up to our blind spots. So Sangha or community just shows us where we may have been holding on to views and opinions that are not onward leading or helpful, skillful. And so in addition to helping us to help us wake up, Sangha can help us hold the hard. And the image that comes up for me, just it was when I was practicing in northern Thailand, there was a really old and huge Bodhi tree on the monastery, and it was planted there from a sapling from the original Bodhi tree under which the Buddha had become enlightened. And then for any of you who know what a Bodhi tree looks like, the branches were big and thick and really sprawling. And this was like a sacred monument of sorts for the village in which the monastery was located. And so in order to make sure none of the branches would break, the village had these wood, almost like pitchforks, so like a two-pronged fork, but they were painted so ornately, and there was like, I don't know, dozens and dozens of them propping up the big branches of the tree. And it was just so beautiful. It was like this piece of art, but then there was this historic symbolism, but this coming together of this matters to us. And so I kind of think of that when I think of Sangha helping us hold our suffering. It helps us touch into this interbeing or this interconnection that goes beyond just the human realm, but that can begin to touch into the plant and animal and mineral realms. I think it was Kittisaro who shared this quote, and I caught only the first two lines from Master Hua. All living beings are my family. The universe is my body. One of the most moving collective grieving ceremonies I was a part of was January before pandemic, so January 2020. Gulu and I, we graduated from the Spirit Rock teacher training, and at the same time, there was the IMS teacher training. And so the cohorts got together, and we had our own retreat without any adults around, none of the senior teachers. At the Land of the Medicine Buddha, a retreat center, like around here. I don't know where, but I'm not from here, but you know, somewhere in Northern California where there were redwoods. And then we did this, this ceremony, asking for forgiveness and honoring the earth. And it was coming from the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition because one of our peers, Kyra Jewel Lingo, who wrote the book, actually, We Were Made for These Times, which really touches on a lot of what we've been talking about all week. She was a Thich Nhat Hanh nun or from that lineage for many years. And so we did this ceremony called the Four Earth Holder Touchings of the Earth. And so about a dozen or so of us, we walked in silence through the woods and we found a clearing. And in this clearing, there were Tibetan flags, Buddhist flags hanging and sort of altars around just people having placed rocks or feathers or pictures. And it was such a beautiful ceremony, and you can find it online. And we honored and we asked for forgiveness, in particular from people, animals, plants, and minerals. And I'll read just one of the sections because I just find it so moving. And it was, and in this section, it's around the plants. But again, there's like the four sections. So I really encourage you to look it up after the retreat. So it says, "Dear Buddha, we see the ways we have believed we are separate and made the separation into systemic otherizing of plants. We have lost touch with the miracles of tree, shrub, grass, and seeded lives with their roots in the ground. And seeded lives with their roots in the ground. We do not notice the communities in which plants live, communicating to one another through their roots. They share the water, the sun, and soil, give oxygen and absorb CO2. We forget to notice how plant life enriches our lives due to our daily contact with its beauty and calming nature. This separation has led us to poison our fields, create genetically modified foods, create seed that cannot be saved, and led us to losing much of our plant gene heritage. We have lost touch with the sacred cycle of the seasons and growth. Our forests and all who live within them are hurting due to wildfires, overheating, and drought. We have burned uncounted acres of rainforest, adding more CO2 to an increasingly hot planet. We have also cut down trees for personal gain, forgotten how to identify wild plants, as well as how to grow our own food. We allow ourselves to grieve this mistaken belief and all the harm it has caused. We know in truth we cannot be separated from our plant siblings. Just as we cannot live without food, we are inextricably connected. We vow to remember our interbeing. We give our grief to the earth, and in doing so, we are able to transform it, refresh ourselves, forgive ourselves, and each other, and we begin anew." And that part about, "and we give our grief to the earth," in some ways, that's what I feel like we do when we're bowing. It's like we're returning to the earth our grief, asking for forgiveness. Apparently, Carl Jung has talked about the collective unconscious. And so if there's a collective unconscious, then a collective consciousness is possible. In a training I did, this facilitator from Wise Bridge, which is a global transformative advising, training, and consulting group, and her name is Akaya Winwood, had come to guide us through a facilitation. And I don't recall the details of it, but there's one part that really impacted me, and I want to just invite you to do the same reflection. And so I think, like, pretty as soon as we started, it was on Zoom, and the invitation was to close our eyes, and you could close your eyes or turn your eyes downward, and you don't have to change postures or anything. It'll be about a minute or two. But to turn your attention inward and bring to mind or imagine the world in 250 or 300 years. And try to imagine what you see around you, where you are. You might not know, say, the location or the city, but just general landscape. And then this young being appears and walks through your landscape. What is their demeanor? Then you can gently blink your eyes open or lift your gaze. And And I recall there being more to this invitation that Akaya led us through, but I think I got stuck there trying to recall it for this evening, partly because I remember feeling like I didn't do it well or right. And that's, again, the perfectionist. But, and I guess she picked up on it because when we all got back together, she was like, anybody want to share? And no one shared, no one raised their hand. And then she's like, Dawn. And I was like, oh, she can pick up on me, you know, and then I said, I don't think I did it right because my visual kept flip-flopping back and forth between this apocalyptic view and this view where it was beautiful and this child was happy and there was just lightness. And then it would flip back and forth. And she was like, exactly. That is why we need to practice. We are at a place where either one can come true. And it is because of our collective choices and what we do together as a collective that can make one more true than the other, or one come to fruition. Tanisra talked about the internal-external practice. I think it was in last night's talk, and in a lot of ways, it invites us to increase our awareness, to increase our learning, so that it feeds back into our actions, to what can create less suffering in the world. And so I hope that you're seeing how it's helpful to see how your mind or how the mind works, not just for your own liberation, but for the liberation of all. When we don't live in our bodies, for example, we'll take any chance to escape it. And we're beginning to see that in big and extreme ways. Our body is earth. And yet some are denying it so deeply, they are rushing to find a new home in outer space. When we don't love ourselves fully, we deny our own sacredness, opting out of that sacred web of life. And doing so, not loving ourselves completely, increases the chances of not seeing the sacredness in others, in other people, regardless of where you were born or what your first language is, regardless of your socioeconomic, citizenship, or marital status, your level of education, your experience of practice, your sexual orientation or sexual identification, your age, your shape, your beliefs or your religion, regardless of the color of your skin, your origin, your race, you are sacred. Regardless of your mental or physical ability or your mental or emotional states, your political affiliation, you are sacred. And then once we can touch into that, and the quote, everything terrible needs our love. It's like once we can touch into that, then of course, animals, plants, minerals, Mother Earth, Mother Nature, Grandmother Earth, that gets included. What we're doing, what brought us here, this act of self-love and self-compassion, is the doorway to compassion for all, and engaged compassion. One that we are inspired to act from. Love and compassion being our undercurrent. More so than fear and hostility. That'll still arise, most likely. But love and compassion are the undercurrent. you feel called to, you can close your eyes. Letting whatever words land, let them land on your heart. Let them inspire your being. And the words that are floating away, they're recorded. You could listen to it again. All living beings are my family. The universe is my body. May the merits of our practice benefit all beings without exception, sentient and animal, human, plant, mineral, and spirit beings. May we all be able to experience freedom. May we know happiness. May we be healthy and strong, awaken and be free. May there be knowledge, wisdom, justice, equity, community, compassion, wellness, transformation, evolution, balance, honesty, reliability, integrity, art, liberation, serenity, courage, communication, decolonization, re-indigenization, and joy in the world. Thank you for your practice, for holding our suffering together.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.